Call the meeting to order. Representative Murdoch, having thoroughly reviewed the minutes of the last meeting, will move those minutes. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Thank you, Representative Davids. Duly noted. House File 2903 is Representative Wagenius's bill. For folks that aren't familiar with Liquor Day here in the Commerce and Labor Committee, there are no samples, by the way. But we take up all of the various bills that are on the agenda. They will all be laid over for potential inclusion in an omnibus bill, which will be presented on Thursday of this week. And that will then wrap up. The Senate does the same thing in their body, and then we try to match up those two bills. We have first up then is the chair will move House File 2903 for potential inclusion in the omnibus liquor bill. Representative Wagenius, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Atkins, and thank you for moving the bill. This is a short bill which would allow the city of Minneapolis to issue an on-sale intoxicating liquor license to the Museum of Russian Art. The museum is in my district. It's right on the freeway at 35W and Diamond Lake Road. And with me is Judy Dutcher, who's the executive director, who will tell you a little teeny bit about it. And then Pierre Ouellette from the city of Minneapolis, who hopefully will give his blessing because it's in a building that was an old church.
Well, Representative Wagenius, you are setting a shining example for others to follow. brief testimony from the proponent, somebody that says they don't object, and away we go. So, Ms. Dutcher, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Judy Dutcher. I'm the executive director of the Museum of Russian Art. I want to thank Representative Wagenius for bringing this bill forward. We had been working with the city of Minneapolis for the past 3 years to try and get permission for our caterer, D'Amico Catering, who is a licensed caterer with the city, the ability to sell alcohol by the glass at special events at the museum. This is kind of commensurate with other cultural organizations within the city of Minneapolis. And so ultimately was recommended to me by our council member Benson to work with Representative Wagenius so that we're able to have this law passed. We would then go to the city of Minneapolis and work with them to ensure that we're compliant with all of their licensure requirements.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dutcher. Mr. Ouellette, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to say very briefly that the city of Minneapolis has no objections to this legislation and supports the application for the liquor license.
Very good. Thank you. Is there anyone else who desires to testify with respect to House File 2903? Questions or concerns from members of the committee? Seeing none, the chair then will lay over House File 2903 for potential inclusion in the omnibus liquor bill.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Members, I would
Representative Wagenius
invite you to come to the museum if you've never been there. It is a treat. And very different. But it's easy to get off the freeway and stop in the church parking lot and come on in.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius. Now that you can serve wine and stuff,
we'll be there.
We'll be much more likely that our committee will show up there.
Thank you
very much. Next up is House File 2973, Representative Murphy's bill. The chair will move House File 2973 for potential inclusion in the omnibus liquor bill. Representative Murphy, it's my understanding there is an amendment that is an author's amendment. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. The chair will then move the A10-2251 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Murphy, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm really glad to be before the Commerce Committee, and I'm really glad to have a piece of legislation that could be considered for the omnibus liquor bill. It's the first time for me. This would provide an on-sale intoxicating liquor license for the University of St. Thomas.
Very good.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson, welcome to the committee. Anything you want to tell us about what's being proposed?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doug Hennis. I'm Vice President for University and Government Relations at St. Thomas. We want authority to approach the cities of St. Paul and Minneapolis to obtain a liquor license for use of both in Minneapolis and St. Paul on our campuses. In the past, we have obtained temporary one-day licenses for various events if we were actually going to sell alcohol, for example, at homecoming. We've been advised that we need such licenses on any occasion where we may charge for an event like a reunion, a dinner, and then we give away wine at the table. We've been advised that we need temporary licenses for those kinds of events as well. And since there are a number of those during the year, it just makes more sense from a practical point of view as well as a timing point of view to obtain a permanent license. So what we would do with the legislature's approval is then approach the cities of St. Paul and Minneapolis to obtain licenses on an annual basis. We have talked with neighborhood organizations, both in Minneapolis and St. Paul. There's been no objections to this. We've also talked with our city council members from Russ Stark in St. Paul and Lisa Goodman in Minneapolis, and they are comfortable with the legislation as well, as long as there's no opposition from neighborhood groups. The last thing I would note is that we have no intention of opening a bar on campus. This is strictly for special events, typically attended by alumni or donors.
Mr. Ennis, I think you just lost Representative Hoppe's vote. He was going the right way there for Representative Hoppe.
Well, Mr. Chair, as a graduate of St. John's University, I would encourage members to support this, because if I were going to St. Thomas, I'd want to drink too. So, I'm a co-author. I'm a co-author. Please vote aye.
And so it begins.
Mr. Chair, I would note that St. John's does have a bar on campus, correct?
As it should be.
I think we it would not be a wise move for St. Thomas to have a bar on campus.
Thank you, Mr. Hennis. Thank you, Representative Murphy. Is there anyone else who desires to testify with respect to House File 2973 as amended? Any other comments or questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, the chair then will lay over House File 2973 as amended for potential inclusion in the omnibus liquor bill. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And our best dressed representative today, I think I saw him walk in, Representative Purcell. The chair will move House File 3235 be recommended for possible inclusion in the omnibus liquor bill. This is the Bemidji Regional Event Center. Representative Purcell, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill is. Is to provide an on-sale license for our new regional event center, and there's some special provisions that require us to need this, and I'm going to let Mr. Bob Lehman, executive director of the event center, and also have Mayor Richard Lehman, Bemidji Mayor, with me here today, and they can speak to the fine points of this.
All right. Thank you, Representative Purcell. Did you point out to your testifiers, by the way, that we actually held up on doing the liquor bill until Bemidji Day here at the Capitol, just so you all could come dressed like that?
We appreciate that, Mr. Chair. And you know, Paul Bunyan was known to imbibe from time to time, don't we?
Mr. Lehman or Mr. Lehman?
It's LeBaron, but thank you. Thank you, Chairman. The bill would allow us to sell intoxicating beverages at the Regional Event Center. It's a 4,600-seat arena and a 10,000-square-foot convention center space. Legislation as it's currently written would allow the city to issue a license to the convention center portion, but not the arena portion. So this kind of clears up the ambiguity as to whether both sides of the venue would be able to serve alcohol.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor, anything else?
I want to thank you all for your support on this bill and invite you over to the reception at Kelly Inn afterwards, because I guess everything else has been said already. So
you must have heard the Russian Museum pitch that was made earlier about
exactly.
Going there, so you figured you've used this opportunity to invite us to Bemidji Days. Thank you, by the way, for and pass along our appreciation. We do tourism in this committee as well. We certainly appreciate you coming down and visiting with us today, and hope you'll carry that
message. We appreciate the opportunity
back
to address the committee, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
All right. Any other? Are you guys aware of any opposition to it? Is there anyone else here in the audience who wants to testify to it? Questions or concerns from members of the committee? Seeing none, the chair then will lay over House File 3235 for potential inclusion in the omnibus liquor bill.
Thank you, Mr.
Gentlemen.
Chair.
Thank you,
Senator
Mr. Purcell.
Thank you very much. Next up is. Is Representative Seifert is being run for, right? So we'll come back to his momentarily. We've got, what's that? Hoppy. Should we use Hoppy?
That's got a good chance.
Oh, we got Hoppy. I almost skipped you, Representative Hoppy. We've got Representative Hoppy, then we'll move House File 3481 yes. For potential inclusion in the omnibus liquor bill. Representative Hoppy to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I do have Mr. Bagnoli coming up. He's coming up to explain it. It's a relatively simple bill, and I'll let him take it from here.
Thank you, Representative Hoppe. Mr. Bagnoli, welcome back.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Joe Bagnoli with McGranche Law Firm on behalf of the Municipal Beverage Association and the Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association. This bill is sort of an extension of last year's bill right now under current law, and we just neglected to do it last year. Right now under current law, a liquor store that wants to do a tastings off-premises can do it at a establishment that that has a the appropriate liquor license. However, we're only allowed to do wine tastings off-premises. We can't do beer tastings or spirit tastings. This extends the same provisions and the same requirements that we have for wine tastings to allow for beer and spirits tasting off-premises. They will have to have a insurance, have to be at a licensed facility that has licensing for spirits and or wine or beer. That's what it does. I'm not aware of any opposition and appreciate your support.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bagnoli. Anyone else desires to testify with respect to House File 3481? Questions or concerns from members of the committee? Representative Hoppe then will renew his motion that House File 3481 be laid over for potential inclusion in the omnibus liquor bill. I haven't seen Representative Seifert come in yet, so the normally the chair would hold on. I wouldn't hear my bills till the end, but since this is the liquor portion of the agenda, I'm going to take up House Files 2974 and 3186 and turn it over to Vice Chair Lilly. If Representative Seifert does come in, we should take his as soon as he gets here, please.
Chair moves that House File 2974 be laid over for possible inclusion into the ominous liquor bill. Chair Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Simple bill. This would allow the state fair to issue liquor licenses. Currently, the state fair licensees go through Ramsey County. And the state fair and Ramsey County have come to an agreement. Ramsey County really doesn't want to do it anymore and is comfortable with the state fair issuing their liquor licenses. And so that's what this bill does, and I'd appreciate your support for it.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, on page 3, line 3.2, 3.3, the Agriculture Society shall license and regulate the sale of tobacco on the state fairgrounds. Can you even smoke on the state fairgrounds?
Yeah, that's the other part that it's.
Chair Atkins.
And I apologize. It also, I should have pointed out, and thank you for reminding me, it allows them to issue a wine license, and it allows them to, to clarify that the state fair shall license and regulate the sale of tobacco on the fairgrounds. I think there might be somebody here from the state fair that would know whether or not you can. I haven't smoked there in years.
Mr. Bagnoli, please state your name. And
members of the committee, Joe Bagnoli, McGranche Law Firm on behalf of the state fair. The state fair right now does not currently license anyone to sell tobacco at the fair. I don't believe that tobacco smoking is forbidden at the fair, but no one is licensed to sell tobacco at this point at the fair.
Well,
Representative
Mr. Chair
Davids.
And Mr. Bagnoli, by giving them this consideration here, could they say they were not going to issue any permits and ban tobacco smoking on the state fairgrounds?
Mr. Bagnoli.
I don't think that this provision came up. Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, this provision came about because right now, currently, Ramsey County has the authority to license the sale of tobacco. This would only change for the sale of tobacco to give the fair the ability to sell tobacco. It doesn't indicate whether or not they're able to ban it or not ban it. I'm honestly not sure whether they ban it or don't ban it there.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bagnoli, just the thought that, you know, giving them that power, they could just say we're not going to have any on the state fairgrounds at all.
Mr. Bagnoli.
I think they, Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, I think they currently have that authority to do whether they.
Mr. Chair, they can do it anyways, apparently. Yeah. So.
Chair Atkins.
That was the point I was going to make. Under the language here, it just regulates the sale of tobacco on the fairgrounds, not whether or not they can ban it or not ban it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Anybody in the audience like to be heard for or against this bill? With that, the Chair lays over House File 2974. Representative Seifert? Seifert?
He's going to be governor. You ought to at least pronounce his name.
How did Farm Fest? Farm Fest end up all right? We had no deaths out there, right? With our doors put on there and everything.
Everything worked out well.
Thank you. The chair.
Where is it?
The chair moves that 3518 be laid over for possible. For possible inclusion. Representative Seifert, please to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, we had a little discussion on the floor in the regard to this bill. It stems from a fee that went up. I believe it was in 2005 omnibus bill on. Vodka distilleries in Minnesota. The House research folks did a little digging for me in the meantime and found out there are only two manufacturers that now pay this fee that are left. Pretty much everyone else has been driven out of the state or that the ones that wanted to locate here went elsewhere. I do have some information from a gentleman who had planned on opening one in Windom, Minnesota. He had said that due to the excessive nature of the distiller's fee in Minnesota, he decided to locate in Iowa. He knows of two other distillers in Iowa just across the border from Minnesota to avoid this fee, and also noted that 45th Parallel Vodka moved to Wisconsin for the very same reason that the other three distillers moved to Iowa, which was the $30,000 fee. That was in place in Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, I think all of us understand that when we get to the point of being too egregious on either fees, taxes, or assessments, or otherwise, that people make a value judgment and leave or not start their business here. Unfortunately, they do not score these things dynamically. In other words, if we were to anticipate other vodka distillers to be opening in Minnesota, and there is a person out in western Minnesota who would like to open up a distillery in or near Canby, I believe, and you know the number of jobs could be as few as three or four or as many as three dozen, depending on how these businesses take off, Mr. Chair. But the Revenue Department never scores these things with the but-for test, which in other words is but for this fee, you would have businesses opening in Minnesota. They only look at it statically. So we have to apparently come up with $59,300, I think, to pay for this. I did call Mr. Carger in the jurisdiction. I believe that this falls under his public safety of some sort. But it is a general fund impact, Mr. Chair. And so I don't know if an amendment was drafted that was handed out, but essentially they said you know they would try to come up with $59,000 out of I think it was alcohol and something or another enforcement, and it would be less than 1% impact.
I don't believe we have an amendment in our packet. Is there? We do have one. Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Chairman, the amendment was drafted, but I don't think it ever got to the CA, or we had a mix-up between a CA and I. The amendment essentially adds a section to the bill which adjusts the appropriation for the Department of Public Safety. I can either run up to my office and grab a copy of the amendment, or I can do an oral version of the amendment and then clean it up at a next stop, as you wish.
If Mr. McCormick, if you're willing to offer it oral, we can incorporate it at this time.
Madam Chair, the oral, or Mr. Chair, I have a Madam Chair in my other committee.
I haven't had my surgery yet.
On page 2, after line 11, insert section 2. Adjustment, the annual budget of the Department of Public Safety shall be reduced by $59,000 per year. Mr. Chairman, between here and the next stop, I'll insert the actual citation for the budget bill adopted to, as a technical amendment.
Thank you, Mr. McCormick. Any questions to that? Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McCormick, would that be to the overall budget or a certain section of the department?
There
Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are two choices. The way I drafted it, it would be a $59,000 reduction to the overall department. If you say, if you added to the last that, the words, to the liquor control division, then that would be specifically to that division.
Representative Davids.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to go with the amendment that says that it's the overall budget, not specifically to one area, because that one area could be very small. It could have a greater impact. I think if it's the overall budget, it'd be much more easy. Be much more easy to absorb it. That, so, Mr. Chair, I would move the amendment of what Mr. McCormick said the way I want it.
Is that clear to all members? Any questions? All those in favor of the amendment, the oral amendment, in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment adopted. Any questions for the author to his amended bill? Anybody in the audience like to be heard for or against the bill? Yeah, Representative
pass.
Hoppe.
Pass, Mr. Chair.
With that, the chair lays over House File 3518 for possible inclusion. Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank
you. As amendment.
Thank you.
Chair Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, I'd move for possible inclusion House File 3186. And then there are a couple of amendments, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
The first one is the A1 amendment. It's an author's amendment. This is an issue that was brought to my attention by Mr. Pender, and it is relative to, I believe, Mr. Pender, it was a recent court decision, and it, Mr. Chairman, if I might, maybe, Mr. Pender, are you able to do a little quicker summary of it than I can?
Mr. Pender.
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's a recent decision by the Minnesota Supreme Court. The case involved a policy issued by the Joint Underwriting Association, a dram shop policy, and the issue was whether it complied with our law. And basically, the court said that our law was not clear on that issue, and decided what the law. What the law means, and this amendment on lines 1.20 to 1.21 basically enacts the decision of the Minnesota Supreme Court. The opinion was written by Justice G. Barry Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Pender.
And it was a six to nothing decision with one justice not participating.
Chair Atkins.
I would move the A1 amendment then, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment adopted. Chair Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's next up is the A2 amendment. This is also one that I do not believe is controversial. It is with respect to insurance and that it talks about an addition of when insurance would not be required. For licensees who establish, and there's four currently. The fifth one would be for wholesalers who donate wine to an organization for a wine tasting, conducted under a certain area of the statute.
Chair Atkins, just to interrupt for a second, I'm sorry.
Is this the PMO 79?
79.
Maybe you want to cover the 79 first. A2 has not been passed
out. That's fine. The PM 079 amendment is one that I believe may be more controversial, and I'm not asking it be part of the bill today. It was brought to our attention a couple of days ago, and I wanted to make sure that the committee was aware of it, because it may well be offered at some point in some location, and whenever that's going to happen, I certainly want to not hide the ball from folks. So, Mr. McCormick, I know, drafted it. If you'd be so kind as to give a brief walkthrough of the PM 079 amendment.
Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, the first section is going to be superseded by the A2 amendment, and should not be controversial, but we should debate that as in the form of the A2 amendment. The second section is more controversial. When wine coolers were first introduced, so wine coolers were sold and marketed and classified for regulatory purposes as an intoxicating malt liquor beverage. And that allows them to be sold, for example, in a grocery store, and that's why you can go to a grocery store and see wine coolers there for sale with a 3.2 alcohol with the beer. One of the provisions in law regulates credit sales and credit extensions for malt liquor beverages. And some existing wine cooler and wine-related products were allowed to use the same credit extension and credit sales regulations that regulate malt liquor beverages in Minnesota. And that may be changing. What this provision does is say that if you were a wine cooler that was allowed to use these credit-based extensions and credit-based provisions prior to January 1, 2010, then you may be continued to be purchased through the credit sales and credit-related transactions on an ongoing basis. That's my brief description. The department may have a better description, or they may not want to weigh in. I'm not sure.
Okay. Thank
Chair
you.
Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. McCormick. I am aware of at least two folks that have raised opposition to that portion of the amendment, namely Section 2, and that is the Minnesota Beer Wholesalers Association and the Teamsters. I am not moving to make it part of the House File 3186. As you probably have figured out, 3186 is going to be the vehicle for the liquor omnibus bill. I would recommend that members give a look to Section 2. That may arise in the Senate's bill, or it may arise as an amendment on the House floor, but I don't intend to move ahead with it, but wanted to make sure that people were aware of it. What I would suggest that we do with respect to the A2 amendment, my understanding, Mr. Chairman, that's not in people's packets.
Yes. Yes, sir. That's correct.
What I'd like to do is provide you with the language. We'll distribute the amendment. As you all know, this bill is being laid over for possible consideration on Thursday. So I'm going to tell you what that amendment does. We'll then bring that language, absent objection or any controversy about it. We'll bring that language with us on Thursday. Does that sound all right?
Sure.
All right. Then all that language does is it deals with, as I said before, those wholesalers who donate wine for a wine tasting event. And we'll make certain that you get the language. But with that, Mr. Chairman, the underlying bill is simply a technical change that I believe was going to be in a corrections bill or revisers bill last year for the city of Minneapolis with respect to a liquor license at 2124. Coma Avenue Southeast. Since that bill did not get off the floor, or didn't get done last year, we've decided to do that this year. We'll use that as the vehicle and bring the various other bills that you've heard earlier today, whichever ones make it into the omnibus bill, for further discussion on Thursday. And with that, Mr. Chairman, then I would renew my motion that House File 3186, as amended, be recommended or be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill on Thursday.
Thank you, Chair Atkins. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed?
Thank you very much.
I'm sorry. We're laying it over for possible inclusion. Sorry about that. Do you want Dale? Representative Dale, are you?
He was here.
Chairman, we could do yours real quick. We could, but We've got, I know Representative Simon's got other obligations as well, and I think he's got some people here as well, don't you? All right, so Representative Simon, then we'll move House File 3277, be recommended to pass and referred to, actually, Representative Simon, it's my understanding from Chairman Mullery that if it is in Section 325, that he wants to see it in civil law. Is that your understanding as well?
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. We had a discussion about that. That was his initial inclination. I have to say, I wish he was here. This is the first that I've heard that he wanted that. He didn't put in any sort of formal request, but you know, I leave it to you, Mr. Chair, as to how you want to handle that.
Well, he expressly said it to me. Okay. And I think what I'd prefer to do out of the gentlemanly and professional way that we do business here is we will move it to civil law. We'll give you an opportunity to visit with Chairman Mullery. There may be some meeting of the minds, and then if need be, and without objection from Representative Hoppe and his members, we would move it out of civil law to the floor.
Okay. So I guess my motion then, Mr. Chair, would be that I move that House File 3277 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice.
Thank you, Representative Simon. And it's my understanding that you have a DE-1?
I do.
So Representative Simon then will move the DE-1 amendment to his bill. That is an author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Simon,
thank
then
you.
To your
fine.
Bill is amended.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members. You know, around this place, we get an earful of false choices. A lot of time you hear, well, you're either for jobs or you're for the environment. Or you're for civil liberties, or you're for being tough on crime, as if those things are, you know, mutually exclusive. We got another one here today that I'm hopeful that we can resolve. Often you hear that people are either pro-business or pro-consumer, and I'm happy to say that I believe this bill is both. It came to me from business, but it's also a bill that very much helps consumers. And the DE amendment gets it into the better shape. And members, you may have seen it introduced as something that pertains only to florists and locksmiths. And a lot of people thought, and I agree, that that seems to be an odd combination. The DE amendment, though, gets it into a shape where it's really applicable to just more than those two professions and occupations. And let me describe, before I turn it over to the testifiers, what we're really talking about here, members. There's a scam that's routinely perpetrated not only in Minnesota but in other states. And if we pass this, we'd be following the example of the states of Texas, Maryland, and North Carolina, which have already passed similar bills. And here's how the scam works. You'll have folks coming in targeting industries like the locksmith industry and the florist industry, but others as well. They're the ones who have been the most vocal. And what they'll do is this. They'll take out either an internet ad or a print ad or a Yellow Pages ad in, say, Invergrove Heights, Mr. Chair, and they'll call themselves Invergrove Heights Florist. And they'll take out a Yellow Pages ad or an internet ad to that effect. And everything looks fine. There's a 651 area code. They're calling themselves Invergrove Heights florists. And the consumer in Invergrove Heights or anywhere else will call up that company after they see the ad. But what's really going on is their phone call is being routed somewhere else, say New Jersey. And they aren't located in Invergrove Heights at all. And what they'll do is they'll take an order for, say, a dozen roses for $20, let's say. And they'll take that order over the phone. And what happens is that they'll then turn around and they'll place an order with a real Invergrove Heights florist. And it'll be, say, $16 for a dozen roses. And they'll pocket the other four. Meanwhile, the consumer doesn't know what's going on, but they've just paid $4 extra for roses. And, of course, it crowds out the real Minnesota businesses, either florists or locksmiths. And that's what's going on, and you'll hear some anecdotes and stories here from a couple of these testifiers that are very interesting. These are hardworking business people, and they feel that they and, just as importantly, their customers are being scammed. So, members, if I could turn it over, I'd like to turn it over first to Steve McCullough.
Well, can we try to guess whether he's a florist or a locksmith?
Sure.
All right, all in favor of florist. And the audience can vote here, too. Who says he's a florist? All right, who says locksmith? I guess you're neither. But we just did it, and I got glazings memorized, so I've never actually had to Google them. But you're right, it happened as we were Googling them right here. All right. Yes, sir. Thank
you.
Well,
I am a florist. my name is Steve McCullough. I own Linsk Florist in St. Louis Park and have owned it since 1990. I guess a couple of stories that I can tell about this. First of all, I had Buzz Anderson in my office one day when I was first getting him interested in this issue. And we opened up the phone book and called Crystal Floral and got a guy on the phone, and I talked to him about what he was what he had to sell, and then I asked him where his shop was, and he wouldn't tell me. And I continued to press him, and he hung up on me. Because they don't want you to know that they're not in the metro area. I then called Edina Floral, which is also in the phone book, got the same guy on the phone. And so that's, you know, they're services, and it can be anywhere, and it can be in New Jersey, it can be in Bangalore, it could be just about anywhere. But more personally than that, a couple of years ago, we got an order from one of these 800 services, and it was for a residence right behind our store. And we were given $35 for the arrangement. So we did the arrangement, took it back there, and later on that afternoon, the gentleman came up to the store very angry because he had spent $75, and why was I trying to cheat him with this little bouquet that I had done? He thought, because it was St. Louis Park Floral, he thought he was dealing with my store. Now, if he had called us directly, we would not have charged him anything for delivery, but that service charged him. He showed me the bill that he got. They charged him for the arrangement. They charged him a expediting fee. They charged him an afternoon delivery fee, and it was a $75 bill to him. And what the florist or the 800 service transferred to us was $35. So he was scammed to the tune of $40. So we're not asking that anything be done to outlaw 800 numbers. I mean, we certainly do that, but what we need to do is have people represent where they're located. That's
thank
all we're
you,
asking.
Sir. And I think okay. One, Representative Davids, do you have a question for this fellow?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the gentleman that just testified. How would this affect like an arrangement like FTD or something? I call FTD and... like when you do something real stupid, you've got to figure out why you feel what type of thing.
It won't because FTD, you're dealing with local florist. And if you call FTD, they will tell you where they're located. Any FTD florist will tell you where they're located.
Are you an FTD
representative?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your testimony. I should ask, is there anybody here to oppose this bill? Okay, well, you're all right. You can still testify. Just don't mess it up, I guess, is what I'm saying. by the way, my vote is for Flores.
Good bet.
All right. Well, welcome to the committee.
Hi, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Kim Erickson, and I am the president of the Minnesota State Florist Association. I represent over 450 florists in the state of Minnesota. And this problem that Steve just described is a problem that happens every single day in every single flower shop in every state, but in Minnesota is where we're trying to direct it. I wanted to tell you, I saw you Google Invergrove. If you go right now and discount flowers, comma Minneapolis on Google, you will see two flower shops that come up, and neither of them are real flower shops, and they do have an address, but they are, if you Google them further and look at them on the map, they are a post office. Oh. You're going to a post office, and it has a local phone number. This morning, I called a 763 number. I forget which one it was, one of the two that you'll find there. And I pressed that gentleman to where he was located, that I really needed to pick up a corsage. And he said, you know what, ma'am, we don't sell corsages. He would not give me his address. I know for a fact that this gentleman was located in Medford, Oregon. So... and he would call this a network of florists that would get me a corsage delivered, but I could not pick it up at his location. They are tacking on exorbitant soup service fees. I had a customer at Christmas that placed an order in my flower shop for $42 is the order that I got. She paid $98.99. She paid a tax in another state. She didn't pay a tax here in our state. She paid $20 service charge. She paid a delivery charge. She paid a relay charge. And she paid an afternoon special delivery charge, which, by the way, they asked me to deliver it the next day, not the afternoon she asked it. So, and I can tell you stories from florists all over the state of Minnesota that this is happening every day. And if there's any other questions, I'd be glad to answer them for you.
Well, thank you very much. Representative Simon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We just have someone else here who would be available to answer questions. Okay. He doesn't need to testify. He is, in fact, a locksmith. So, not a florist. But the point is,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, how do you do this with locksmith? I can see the scam for flowers. That's one question. What's the scam on the locksmith? And number two is do other states, have other states passed similar laws such as this?
26 states so far.
How many, Mr. Chairman?
26.
26. But what's the scam on the locksmiths? I haven't figured this one out yet.
Sir, can you approach the microphone either there or...
Just introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Jim Elwood. I own Blaine Lock and Safe in Blaine, Minnesota. And what happens with the locksmithing industry is when it's usually on emergencies service where somebody is either locked out of their home or locked out of their vehicle, and what they do is they go on in your phone or on the internet or just in the local yellow pages, and you look for a locksmith in the area. They will give a cell phone number with the address, which is usually a gas station or a call center office or something like that. They're not truly in that area. They're just advertising that they are part of that. It's the same kind of situation.
So then, Mr. Chairman and sir, so then they call a local locksmith to go do it, give them about half the price of what was charged, and call it a day.
Right. They get a quote on the phone of like $35, and then when the locksmith that shows up from these companies will say, no, that's just our service charge, and then they end up charging like $150 or something like that. It's a bait and switch type of scam.
Sure.
So, Mr. Chairman, David, sure, they're not sending you out to do it. They're sending the guy out and charging.
No. They'll answer their phone locksmith, just a generic locksmith. Our company, like I try to explain to our customers, that we answer our phones, you know, Blaine Lock and Safe, or our full name and stuff like that.
So. Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Anybody else have any questions or concerns? Representative Simon, anything final?
No, all right. Mr. Chair. Then ask for your support.
Representative Simon renews his motion then that House File 3277 as amended be recommended pass and referred to civil law. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Thank you, folks. We appreciate your testimony. It was my understanding, by the way, that we had Representative Dill was presenting a bill. Has he been able to join us again yet? We'll take him as soon as he does. Representative Hoppe, we did get the A2 amendment. It's my understanding that you're comfortable taking House File 3186 off the table. Is that correct?
I think that makes the most sense, Mr. Chair.
All right. The Chair will then move that House File 3186 be taken off the table. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. A2 amendment, the Chair will then move the A2 amendment to House File 3186. For anybody that cares or is paying attention, that is the bill the amendment that I explained earlier, but we just simply didn't have it in members' packets. All in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. The Chair then will move that House File 3186 again be laid over for potential inclusion in the omnibus liquor bill as amended. Next up then, I think the only bill we have left other than Representative Dill's bill is my own, and I still don't see him coming in. So. The Chair will move House File 3146 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register.
We haven't filled the bill yet. So.
It isn't here.
Good guy.
Chair Atkins, I'm a little happy to see there's no amendments, so we can...
There is one.
Oh, there is one. Where is it? Chair Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill, House File 3146, was brought to me by the MFSE group that you're all familiar with. Ms. Rowan is the representative for MFSE. There is also, in addition to their clarifying language and some continuing ed provisions and so forth, I don't think there's any tests, by the way, Representative David, but we'll pin her down on that. The Department of Commerce, though, also had some language that they desired to have in here, non-controversial language with respect to fraternals. And then Mr. Esposito had some language, that I believe, on behalf of some agents, again, non-controversial. And with that, I would appreciate your support. I do have Ms. Rowan here who can walk you through briefly what's in the bill, I think literally in like a minute or a minute and a half, just so that you have a good sense of what's in the bill.
Chair Atkins, do we want to move the A1 amendment to get it into shape?
Yes, please. Thank you for reminding me of that.
A1's been moved. Any questions in regards to A1? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment adopted. Ms. Rowan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. And while this bill might not be the most exciting one you've had before you this year, the chairman says it is. This is the most exciting bill you've had before you this year. And it is very important to the domestic life insurance industry and the 20,000 jobs here that we have in Minnesota. I think everyone should have in front of them a summary of the bill that walks you through each and every exciting provision. I'm happy to answer any questions. I'll just hit maybe a couple of the highlights, relatively speaking. One thing what this bill does is it enhances the solvency of insurance companies, and that's in provisions 2 through 4 and 7 and 8 and the amendment that Chair Atkins added to the bill. It also expands eligibility for group life insurance, modernizes some continuing education provisions, and makes some technical amendments to the guarantee association provisions. And that's about it. So I'm happy to answer any questions, and I'd like to thank Chairman Atkins for carrying the bill.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Ms. Rowan. Is there a special section on STOLI in here?
No.
Okay.
All right.
Good.
Mr. Chairman.
Chair Atkins.
I'll renew my motion then that House File 3146 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? You're on your way, sir. Representative Dale?
You know what, Mr. Chairman?
I think we'll take
I will move. We can start taking testimony. I would feel comfortable doing that. So I will present the beginnings of Representative Dill's bill, and when he joins us, he can certainly add more flavor. House File 1157. I'll move that House File 1157 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. And there is, Mr. Chairman, an author's amendment. It is the A10-2291 amendment, and I will move that to put it in the shape that the author desires to move ahead with it.
Okay, thank you, Chair Atkins. Everybody have the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Chair Atkins, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I would like to do is invite
Chair Atkins. We have sorry to interrupt. We have one more amendment, the A1 amendment.
Right.
And it affects the effective date, changes it. So,
I would, what that is that that's an amendment to the delete all that you just voted on, and it would make the enactment date effective the day after passage or after signature by the governor. So, with that, I will move the A1 amendment to put it in the shape that the author desires to move forward with it.
Thank you, Chair Atkins. Any questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? Amendment adopted.
Thank
you. Go ahead, Chair Atkins. Sorry.
With that, I believe that we have Mr. Anderson and some of the dealers that wanted to. They were sitting here. Has everybody taken off on us?
They're all looking for Dill.
We have.
It's too small. You can't.
And there are a couple of folks that requested to testify from Articat as well as the National Marine Manufacturers Association. And I'd be happy to invite them up to provide their testimony with respect to House File 1157.
You want to start on that? Okay. Go ahead and invite them up.
What?
I don't see. I see some motorsports dealers,
what if we had a hearing
manufacturer, or dealers rather.
Let's just pass it and go.
Oh, no.
Is there a Miss Daly? Please come up.
All right. They're negotiating. Maybe they're up there negotiating.
Chair Atkins.
Mr. Chairman, I think the game plan is we've got Mr. Anderson on behalf of the dealers as well as a couple of the dealers that can walk you through the bill. And then we've got some folks, I believe, from Articat and the marine manufacturers who have some testimony with respect to the bill as well. With that, I will turn it over to Mr. Anderson and hope, as I understand it, by the way, Representative Dill is literally presenting his bill in another committee right now, or he'd be joining us, and as soon as he's done, he will come down and join us in, at his contribution.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Atkins, for your indulgence. My name is Buzz Anderson. I represent the Minnesota Retailers Association. This is a bill that you may have seen before. It's a bill that deals with motorsports and marine dealers and the relationship between they and manufacturers. Every community in Minnesota, almost every community, every district certainly has a motorsports or marine dealer. And in fact, a number of you have manufacturers in your district. The fact is, both are really important to Minnesota. Both contribute a lot to the economics of the state. Both hire a lot of people. In the case of the motorsports and marine dealers, they're hiring 30, 40, 50 people in your communities. They're paying sales taxes. They've built facilities to, in fact, meet the demands of the manufacturers to sell the products and so on. So they made a huge investment by themselves and their families into these businesses. I'm going to call on a couple of them to come down and tell their story in just a minute, but if you, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, let me just walk through the bill. The amendments that I understand you've already added are the delete everything amendment. There's also a delete everything to the delete everything amendment, and that has to do with the enactment date. Mr. Chair, has that been enacted?
Yes.
Okay, very good. So let me just walk through the bill very quickly. Section 1 has to do with definitions. And it defines who an outdoor sports dealer is. It adds a new section in law to include motorsports and boats and watercraft and so on and so forth. It defines what a partnership is and so on and so forth. Section 2 was actually a provision that was requested by the manufacturers, and it just simply says you cannot sell or you cannot, the manufacturer cannot sell and the dealer cannot buy unless a contract is in place and that contract addresses certain things. Section 4 has to do with the manufacturer unreasonably withholding. It says that the manufacturer cannot unreasonably withhold the transfer of the dealership. Section 5 allows the dealer to name a successor in the event of their death or disability. Section 6 allows the successor to succeed the owner if the owner is incapacitated. Section 7 is really the key to the bill. And this portion says that the manufacturer cannot close down a dealership without good cause, and it lists 10 reasons for good cause. These are taken right out of the farm implement dealer law, because farm implement dealers have this protection in Minnesota, as do auto dealers, although the auto dealer protection is certainly more enhanced than this. Please take note of number 10, and this has to do with the requirement by the manufacturer for market penetration by the dealer. We've added one additional provision in here that is unique and is not in the farm implement dealer law, and it says that the manufacturer has to take into consideration certain things like local economic conditions, demographics and unique circumstances that might be taking place within the community. One of the dealers that's going to testify is going to tell you that the dealership, his dealership, had the road, Highway 7, closed in front of the dealership for 7 months. Section 8 deals with, the repurchase after the cancellation with good cause. Section 9 deals with warranties and the fact that the dealers are being required to repair product that they may not have sold, but a line that they carry. And it also says that the dealer will be paid for their shop rate plus 35% as adopted in the memo. Subdivision 8 there was actually requested by the manufacturer, and that says that the manufacturer actually has to do work on product that they don't sell. So Section 10 deals with the status of inconsistent agreements. You might hear one of the testifiers say today that in the past they've been asked to waive their rights under Minnesota law. This says that you can't do that. Section 11 says that either party violates the dealer agreement, the party can bring an action against the alleged violator. And Section 12 applies the dealer agreement as of the adoption of the amendment, effective on date upon final enactment. I'd like to call Bob Weir. You may have seen, excuse me, not Bob Weir. I'd like to call Steve Vandeputty from Brothers Motorsports as a front witness, if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Vandeputty, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
My name is Steve Vandeputty. I'm from Brainerd, Minnesota. I have Brothers Motorsports. We currently employ 30 people. At one time I had 38 employees. I started my business 20 years ago with myself and two employees. Built the business up to 38 employees. Made millions of dollars in capital investments. In 2006, I received a letter from Polaris stating that within 1 week, my dealer agreement would not be renewed and I was no longer a Polaris dealer. When asked why, I never got an answer, the reason why, and I said, if you don't want me as a dealer anymore, all I ask is that you buy my product back and make me whole. They said under Minnesota law they don't do that and they don't have to. End of story. So if you have any questions, I'm all open.
Thank you, Mr. Vandeputty. We appreciate it. Is there anyone else, Mr. Anderson?
Mark Boardman from Beaver Bay Sports in Beaver Bay, Minnesota, who's driven a long ways to be here today. He's also a constituent of Representative Dill, and as some of you may know, and I think Representative Dill would have said, had he been here, that he was planning on buying 10 Lund boats from this guy from his new resort. He talked to him in May. If you'd introduce yourself and tell what happened in June.
Board members, thank you for listening to me here. I'm Michael Wortman. I own Beaver Bay Sports. We bought the existing dealership in 1991. My wife and I, my son and my daughter, and I got millions of dollars invested in our property and our buildings, and I represent 14 lines right now, and I've gotten Lund taken away from me because of, they say, lack of sales and realignment of the territory. And most recently, I just had my Lance camper line taken away from me January 8th that I've had for 7 years. We've sold over $1.5 million worth of their inventory, and needless to say, we just found out Friday that they're reopening up another Lance dealership 30 miles from us. Meanwhile, I'm stuck with my inventory, my parts, and this is some of the frustrations that we have. And I'm concerned about my future with my kids taking over our business if there's going to be any manufacturers that we can represent anymore. And I'm asking for some help from you guys, and I think there's a few other ones here too. And so,
all right, thank you, Mr. Ortman. We especially appreciate you making the trip down. It's not exactly talking or jumping in your car and driving for 15 minutes to get here. So, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. If I could ask one more Mr. person to come to the table, that is Bob Weir from Yamaha Motorsports in Hutchinson, Minnesota. And Bob has a unique story as well in terms of having purchased hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of equipment and then having been canceled after the delivery.
Mr. Weir, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair and committee members, I wasn't really planning to give testimony today. I was going to let a couple other dealers to excel. But since we have a little bit of time here waiting for Representative Dill, I'll just make a few comments. Minnesota is becoming rather unique in the fact that Most of the states have this protection bill, have motorsports and marine protection bills in place. All the states have, I think, have something in place except for about 12 now. Last year, Colorado passed theirs unanimously, and there wasn't any manufacturer that showed up to that particular effort. There was Suzuki, Yamaha, Polaris, Articat, nobody showed up, and it was unanimous. We find ourselves needing some assistance because the dealers are in a David and Goliath situation. We only have yearly contracts or yearly addendums, and we invest an awful lot of money that we cannot recover in a year. With those investments, and I'm the oldest Yamaha motorsports dealer in Minnesota, the second oldest Yamaha Skeeter boat dealer, the oldest Yamaha G3 dealer, pontoon dealer. So we've been around for a long time. And the dealers have been trying to get something in place for a considerable length of time, and to get something in place that's comparable to the car dealer protection laws, the implement dealer protection laws that already the legislature has passed in this state. And I can give you an example of what happened to me and why these laws are important. The dealers are a little bit different than the manufacturers in a big way, because when we start our businesses, we have to sign personal guarantees to guarantee everything that we buy and we purchase. Our houses are on the line, our farms are on the line, whereas the manufacturer doesn't have that type of liability risk. I went to a dealer meeting in August. August, and the manufacturer wanted me to order about $600,000 in a unique product model boat. Given the fact that the main road in front of my store was closed from 1 April to November 15th, that we thought it was not a prudent thing to take all the boats that they requested. And in fact, given the economy situation as well, and the fact that there was approximately 22% carryover product in the United States in the inventory, we cut back on our order and did not take what the manufacturer wanted us to take. So we ordered approximately a third of what they wanted. Two, 3 months later, the product that we ordered started to show up. And at that point, we had not signed a new contract for the previous year, and that's pretty much the way it works. We go to the dealer meeting. They tell us that this is what the manufacturer tells us, this is what they'd like us to order. And then they give us like a 15 or 20-day window to make that order at that time. And the manufacturer sets those milestones, and we haven't got a contract signed at that point. So I made my order. The boats are coming in. I'm paying interest on them. I ordered accessories and everything for the boat line, and I'm waiting for my contract to arrive in October to sign that for the next year. Unfortunately, I got a termination letter from the manufacturer stating that I did not order what they wanted me to order, and therefore I am stuck with the product, the accessories, the parts, and the interest. So we find ourselves in a situation where we have little control over our business, and a lot of times I feel like the manufacturer has actually more control over our business, my business, and other dealers' business than we actually do ourselves. And I think it's long overdue in this state, and hopefully we get some help from this committee and the rest of the legislature to solve this problem in the state of Minnesota, and hope we get it done.
Thank you, Mr. Weir. Appreciate you coming back. Mr. Anderson, I've got... we have to be out of here by about 6 o'clock because we've got the education committee that's coming to this room. I've now given 15 minutes for the proponents. I just want to make sure that there's balance for the folks that are speaking in opposition to it. By the way, Representative Dill, don't you think, has done probably the best job presenting this bill of any bill that he's ever presented?
It's been more. The authors today, he was the most brief.
David, the game plan, we've taken testimony from the proponents, and we've got the bill in the shape that you want to do it. We've now got the opponents coming up for their 15 minutes, and then I'm going to give you the final word to wrap up the bill. Does that sound all right?
And the amendment on the adoption all, got in there?
Yeah. So we've got Ms. Daly and Mr. Dickerson, I believe, asked to testify, and there may be others, I'm sure. But Ms. Daly, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
How'd your other bill go, Representative Dill?
Oh, you get, we're just great.
swimmingly?
Yes.
Good.
Shooting everything that moves. Let the game of fish build all about.
Oh, good heavens. All right. Daly, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Chairman Atkins. I was going to say good evening, but maybe it's good late afternoon, huh? My name is Anna Marie Daly, and I'm counsel for Articat, which is based in Thief River Falls with its corporate offices and sales offices in Plymouth, Minnesota. Articat employs about 1,000 people and sells Articat snowmobiles and ATVs that are distributed worldwide. The economy has hit everyone hard. Articat had 2 workforce reductions last year, 5% in January, and an additional 7% in May. We appreciate the opportunity to express our concerns about HF 1157, legislation for which, from what Articat has heard, there's no rational policy reason, and that will harm Minnesota consumers and Minnesota manufacturers. I want to talk first about the distribution of Articat's products sold worldwide through distributors and dealers. And just as the dealers who testified explained, Articat's products are sold mainly through multi-line dealerships. That means that our products are in the same showrooms as our competitive products, and that the dealers have the decision every single day how many units they're going to buy from Articat, how many units they're going to buy from Polaris, which is a major competitor, or from Suzuki, Kawasaki, Yamaha, Honda. And so the relationships that we have with dealers are very important, but we also have to deal with the fact that we are facing competition all the time. Customers, Minnesota residents, are critical to Articat's business. And they tell us in surveys that dealers are very important in their buying decision. The better the dealers are, the happier the consumers are. And it is the importance of the dealer relationships that led Articat several years ago to host a meeting with Minnesota dealers to find out what their concerns were. At that meeting, the dealers were asked to identify their concerns, and Articat used that information to make some changes and to better its communications with dealers. One of the changes that was made to the Articat dealer agreements, and it was rolled out over a year ago, addresses one of the issues that I've heard Mr. Weir talk about several times, and that has to do with his concern about yearly dealer agreements. Last year, Articat rolled out 3-year dealer agreements to address the concern that Mr. Weir expressed. Dealers are also permitted under the Articat dealer agreement to identify a successor. And you've heard concerns from dealers who just testified that they don't have the right to name a successor. Well, I can tell you that that right is in the Articat dealer agreement, and to date, not one dealer has ever exercised that right to come tell us who they would nominate as a successor. So even though you've been told that this is a concern by the dealers, we give that right, and not one dealer has come forward and said we'd like to exercise that right. HF 1157 would hurt consumers, increase the cost of doing business, encourage litigation, and reduce the ability of Minnesota dealers who are working hard to compete for business in this global economy. One of the other provisions that's in HF 1157 has to do with warranty reimbursement that Mr. Cummins talked about. Articat today offers its dealers the right to obtain reimbursement for their warranty work at in excess of their rates up to 117%. All the dealer has to do is take a few hour, and by a few hour I mean a couple of hours, 2 to 3 hours, online training course that's designed for an Articat dealer to better understand how they can service Articat products. Now, why would Articat be willing to pay up to 117% to a dealer if they take a few hours every year to go online and learn about our products, learn the technical aspects, the new technical aspects of the product? Because we care about consumers. We want the consumers, those who reside in Minnesota, those who are tourists in Minnesota, to be satisfied with the Articat products. Unfortunately, and much to Articat's dismay, when we look at how many Minnesota dealers take advantage of that program, the number is abysmal. 60% of Minnesota dealers who sell Articat products take not any online training. Now, the dealers come to you asking you for the legislature to step in. They say they need your help. When if the dealers really wanted to help, have help, all they have to do is go onto their computer and take that online training course, and they would have that increased warranty reimbursement. Articat has also modified its ordering products so dealers could order ATVs throughout the year. Dealers have expressed concerns in the past about snowmobile inventory. Over the last 3 years, Articat's inventory of snowmobiles at Minnesota dealers has dropped by 51%. This is the give and take that should occur in the business world, and it's the give and take that occurs between Articat and its dealers. Under the terms of the Articat dealer agreement, Articat can terminate only if there's a breach, a material breach of the dealer agreement. Articat's required to give written notice 60 days in advance and an opportunity to cure that deficiency. Dealers, however, can walk away whenever they want to. I want to address this notion that the Minnesota legislation here, HF 1157, is needed because other states have this as well. And first of all, the manufacturers did oppose legislation in Colorado. I know that personally. But with respect to the HF 1157, this is much more than Wisconsin, which has been identified as a comparable law. The provisions in HF 1157 are much more onerous in its successorship rights, in its repurchase rights, in its termination. HF 1157 imposes significant new purchase requirements, which essentially transfers the individual business decisions that the dealers get to make about what units they're buying, what price they sell it for, how long they keep the inventory, up to the manufacturer, who is then stuck with, at the end of the day, with a dealer who can turn over all of that inventory for however long they've kept it. This becomes really critical in this business, unlike the car business or the farm implement business, because power sports products are sold in multi-line dealerships. So if you want to decide one day you want to walk away from Articat and go sell Honda, any dealer can do that and force all of its inventory onto Articat. I want to address one final issue with respect to the importance of this issue to Minnesota manufacturers, and let me just address Articat. Articat, as I mentioned to begin with, sells its products throughout the world, and it has in these three-year dealer agreements a choice of Minnesota law since it is a Minnesota manufacturer. So if this law were to pass, not only Minnesota dealers, but also dealers throughout the country and distributors would end up having the benefit of these restrictions, and it would have very harmful effects on Articat. For that reason, Articat urges you to oppose HF 1157. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Daly. Ms. Dickerson, welcome.
Thank you very much, sir. I have a letter here from Alumacraft that I wanted to pass around while I'm testifying, if you don't mind.
Certainly.
Start at this end and move it around. I love being in a good voting state. You all, whether you know it or not, you're number two in the country in registration. You're number one in the country as far as registered votes per capita.
Who's number one?
In total registration?
Yeah.
Florida.
Yeah.
How about more ice fishing houses?
How about for ice houses? Yeah.
Yeah, oh, yeah, there's snowmobiles, Florida. Yeah, it doesn't go far.
That's snowmobiles. Yeah.
Well, I do represent the National Marine Manufacturers Association. We represent about 1,500 manufacturers around the country, and we represent 13 in Minnesota. That list is Leisure Pontoons and Premier Marine in Wyoming, Alumacraft and St. Peters, Gull Manufacturing and Palm Beach Manufacturing in New Ulm, Weir's Industries St. Cloud, Blue Water in Mora, Ecoa in Bram, and pardon me, I'm sure I'm getting all these names wrong, Crestline, Glastron, and Larson Boats in Little Falls, and Lund Boats in New York Mills. Collectively, the marine industry is on its back. We've lost about 70% of our sales. We've had our largest or second largest boat manufacturer in the world go Chapter 7, be dismantled into parts, and most of it being bought by California investment firm. We have had a tremendous amount of layoffs at every single boat builder in the country, and yet we have a lot of hope that these are going to come back over time. These are high-paying manufacturing jobs, and each company is anxious to bring them back to pre-recession levels. We are fighting for our survival. And yet, during this time, I think that we have seen some tremendous benefits, if you can call it that, from an increased relationship with our dealers. And yet, even then, we are seeing, despite the collective efforts of dealers and manufacturers, that our entire method of coming to market has changed. The old model is gone, and I'll describe that old model to you. It used to be that dealers and manufacturers would go to a dealer meeting and meet in late summer, early fall. The dealers would be asked to place a pre-order. There's no cash on the table. In fact, they don't have to live up to every number that they were to put down. However, it was a number that was used by the factory to run year-round in order to keep employment up and to have those boats available and, frankly, in storage. In some ways, we used this as a way to, as I say, maintain employment. That model no longer exists. Manufacturers and dealers are scrambling to develop a more efficient system that keeps inventories at levels that, frankly, before would have been absolutely absurd, but now is what we are at the position of having to do. It provides boats to buyers as quickly as they can, but they're going to be built as they're sold. A number of new options are in play. Godfrey Marine, which is one of the five most popular boats in the state, for instance, now is going to ask its dealers to place their orders monthly. What does this mean, really, in regard to our legislation? It's before you all today. The bill harms the ability of manufacturers to have the best dealer network possible. There's been a lot of discussion here about parity with the surrounding states, and I'd like to direct you just a moment to this letter from Alumacraft, where he has had many experiences, two of which he outlines in his letter, in Wisconsin, which seems to have come up repeatedly as being, at the very least, what dealers in this state require. Trying to summarize it, what happened was one of his best dealers decided to retire. It was sold to some successful business people that didn't know much about building boats. They failed, despite efforts to keep them alive, and there's a lot more detail in the letter. But in the end, because of the way Wisconsin law was established, and the manufacturer was sued by the dealer, even though there was really nothing done wrong by the manufacturer, he ended up having to settle out of court just to make it go away. And I would encourage you to read it because in the interest of moving along, I have skipped over a lot of the details. But in fact, this dealership was failing. They did their best to keep them alive. And yet, despite those, they ended up getting sued. Because of that and some other issues, Alumacraft has some black holes in Wisconsin. They have chosen not to fill various marketplaces because of the liability of having dealerships that are under these types of protections. It is bad for marine customers. It raises the price of boats. And frankly, I don't think Minnesota, as being as popular a boating state as it is, really wants to have these type of protections, which are in some ways a get-out-of-jail-free card for those for those dealers who make bad business decisions. Under the previous business model that I just described, inventory imbalances were spread out among dealers throughout the country. That's no longer possible because inventory is starting to be built upon order. More so than ever before, if your dealer network is not providing you with those orders, it is a direct line to the factory. There's not the flexibility. There's not the squeeze of being able to squeeze something over to California if they're selling better, and Minnesota might be down for that period of time. It doesn't exist anymore. And so if your dealer network's not delivering, it's going to have much more so than ever before, more than last year and more the year before when I testified regarding this bill, it will have an effect on employment.
And Mr. Dickerson, we're about to be descended upon by a bunch of members of the K-12 Education Committee, and I wanted to make sure that we gave some balance. I actually don't mind giving the opposition even a little bit more time, because obviously there's differences and the supporters are able to sort of combine their arguments. But if you can try to...
Let me give you two things real quick. One is, in the examples that were brought to us by the supporters of the bill, one was one in which a line had been taken away. It was one of his 14 lines, and obviously it was a profit center for him. However, I did find out about that. I'd looked into it, and what it came down to was a business decision as far as where to sell its product. The manufacturer bent over backwards. He said, I will buy back all your inventory, or you can have a year to sell what you have. It's your choice. However, as a marine manufacturer, I'm fighting for survival. I've made a decision that I'm going to have to move on, but I'm going to ease the pain as much as I can. And I think that's a proper way of business to operate. It shouldn't be regulated beyond that. And there was some discussion that seemed to say, you know, the manufacturer said I wasn't doing a good job, and he took away my line. That's my line. He can't take that. Well, that's not really true. It's a shared responsibility. And if one side is not holding up their end, then the other side shouldn't be tied to that. Manufacturers are dropped by dealers. Dealers can be dropped by manufacturers. It is the way of business. And I think that that should be continued to be to allow to flow as private enterprise does. If you start stepping on it, I think you run into the type of problems that you're seeing in Wisconsin, where you have areas not served because manufacturers don't feel like it is in their best interest to go there, despite the fact that they're walking away from business. They cannot take the risk that that law associates with marine dealers and marine manufacturer relationships.
Thank you, Mr. Dickerson.
Thank you.
Mr. Jarkus, welcome back.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, members. In the interest of time, I will be extremely brief. I am here representing Polaris Industries. Business representatives of that company would like to attend but are attending their National Snowmobile Dealers Meeting out of state. I would just say that Polaris Industries' views, I think, were broadly well represented by Ms. Daly with respect to Articat. I would just share these Polaris-specific additional points. Polaris Industries, like Articat and other competitors in the power sports equipment industry, have seen precipitous drop in sales in recent years. That has forced both manufacturers and dealers to work together, quite frankly, in a joint survival mode. Polaris Industries, like Articat, in the changes that Ms. Daly outlined with respect to that company, has instituted significant changes, and I think since Representative Lilly introduced and there was discussion in this committee 3 years ago, broadly similar to the bill that's before you now, I think we've seen significant changes in terms of manufacturer relationships with dealers. Polaris Industries specifically instituted what they call a maximum velocity program, MVP program, which means far greater contact, regular contact between their sales force and dealers, changing from a once every 6 months ordering cycle to a once every 2 weeks ordering cycle, not unlike the marine industry that Mr. Dickerson described, changes in contracts, and I think that it has, I know that it's led to the lowest inventory levels among motorsports dealers who carry the Polaris line in 11 years and vastly improved relationships with those dealers. I would just say, Mr. Chair, that I want to echo Ms. Daly's comments. This bill, I know it's well-intentioned to protect dealers, but the experience of Polaris Industries is that laws like this in other states actually hurt most dealers. It certainly hurts manufacturers and their suppliers, many of whom are scattered across the state of Minnesota. And most importantly, it hurts consumers. And I would hope that this committee would consider the interests of consumers who are not being represented here today.
Thank you, Mr. Georgicus. I had a couple members that had questions, Representative Dabney and Representative Sanders. Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Mr. Georgicus, where is the National Snowmobile Manufacturers Meeting?
Georgicus.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, I don't know.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Sanders?
Someplace probably warm.
Counterintuitive. That was where I was going.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for the manufacturers folks here. Is there anything in House File 1157 here that you would consider non-negotiable in a dealer agreement? Or, in other words, is there anything in here that you would not be willing to negotiate on with the dealer when it came time to renew a contract or write a contract with the dealer? Can a dealer come in and say, I want to negotiate these when they're negotiating a contract with you?
Ms. Daly, you want to take that one?
Sure. I'm understanding your question to be, can a dealer come in and negotiate terms?
Sure.
And the dealers do. From the dealer's perspective, as the dealers testified, some of the big issues really are orders. And the process is like any business process. The manufacturer comes in and says, I'd like you to take this. And the dealer says, no, I don't want to take it. Here's what I'll order. And that's a negotiation. That goes on all the time. From Articat's perspective, every dealer gets to decide how many units they're going to order. They make that individual business decision. And we can recommend, tell them what we'd like them to order. It's like going home and with my kids. I tell them what I'd like them to do for homework tonight, and whether they do it or not, usually it's up to them. But it's the same way in the manufacturer-dealer relationship.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Sanders, anything else? Members, anything else? Representative Dill, final word? Thank you very much for your testimony today.
Thank you.
And you got to be real brief, Representative Dill, if you
don't
mind.
Thank you, Chair Atkins. This is actually one of the best bills I've ever done because I've got to listen to the entire bill almost, and that really it's good to go to school on bills. It helps. First off, the bill is not about vilifying manufacturers, and the bill isn't about vilifying the dealers either. I can tell you in practicality that the manufacturing and retailing and wholesaling in times of trouble always remanufacture or remake themselves to become more efficient, better, improve relationships so that they can stay in business. So the testimony you've heard today is no more than the normal business cycle that should take place and should have taken place not when the times were bad as they are today, but when the times were good, when one of those companies that testified here, sales were going up at a rate of 20% a year. This bill sets the minimum standard for a dealer agreement, not the maximum standard for a dealer agreement. This says that you will do the following, that good cause is defined by this, that you will pay a warranty rate that is the retail rate. It doesn't prohibit them from paying more and adding additional training in to qualify for that. It makes it so that it is limited in terms of buyback to 36 months, and I just want to end my presentation, what little presentation I'm making and what I'd had planned, with the idea that I've had some experience at this in my business career, and how this really works is that the manufacturers come in and they have their dealer meeting, and you go out to Las Vegas or to Phoenix or somewhere warm. And they say, you know, here you've got, you, we're gonna, you know, you have to fill out this form and agreement, and you've got to give us all your financial data and all of this business to make sure you're trustworthy and creditworthy, or at least creditworthy. And if you don't take 20 snowmobiles, or you don't take 10 boats, or you don't take 5 trolling motors, you won't get this rebate, and you won't get that rebate, and you won't get that incentive, or we won't buy down your financing. And so a dealer's sitting there with a whole bunch of inventory. Sometimes dealers aren't the greatest business people on the face of the earth, and they say, geez, you know, I can get my interest bought down for 6 months if I buy this much. Pretty soon it just snowballs. And so there's a way that they kind of have an advantage at times, not all the time. So some of the testimony that has been said is really good on both sides, and some of it isn't so good. And I'd suggest that if the industry, if the car industry, and if the farm implement industry, and the motorcycle industry, and industries across this country and across
this state need minimum specifications for dealer agreements? Why, when we're talking about a very capital-intensive business here, a marine dealer or a multiple outdoor sports equipment dealer, why wouldn't we have at least minimum standards for them to deal between the manufacturers and the wholesalers and the retailers? And so without taking more of the committee's time, answer your questions, and then
thank you, Representative
Davids. I'm sorry that I took so long. I know that it's late.
We, Representative Davids, I get so used to calling on you. Representative Dillett, the proposal certainly bears further discussion, and there's a number of components, perhaps most of the components, that are before civil law, and I appreciate that members stayed away from some of the civil law questions. I believe this is why I know this bill is going there next, and I anticipate some of those very issues will come up. With that, the chair will renew his motion that House File 1157 is amended to be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Dill, and thank you to all those that came here to testify. We appreciate it. Y'all know deadlines are this week, so Thursday is going to be kind of long. I know it's a shocker, Representative Hoppe, but with that, we stand adjourned. We will try to get out, by the way, we'll try to get the agenda out as rapidly as we can. There will be modifications as we go, but we'll do our best to inform you. We're adjourned.
There's still time.